chapter one to practice. Secondly, if you see other people in the class who are still working through things, help them. The best way you can be sure you understand is if you help somebody else understand. And it's very important within this class that we don't have cliques developing, people running off and working in a corner and not talking to other people. So really would want to see all of you talking to all the others. And if you see students who are still working through things, try to help them if you can. This is easily the best way for you to learn, and it'll create the best spirit within the classroom. So I want to encourage you to do that. Having said that, I've printed a little handout for you, and if some of you do want to do a little bit of reading on the side, it's good material. It'll supplement what's in the class. Now, one of the derivations you did in the examples class was to show that this equation, okay, this equation with three terms, this one plus the cycles being zero, was equivalent to this equation. Right? And I think you probably all did it in different ways. Some of you just wrote out the components. That's fine. Just write out 0, 1, and 2, and 3, and do the same for this, and check they're really the same. I want to show you just a little bit fancier way to do it, which shows you some cute identities with tensors. So the symmetric part of a tensor, I already discussed. T mu nu plus T nu mu. The antisymmetric part and what about three index tensors? Let's imagine we have something like that and I want to symmetrize it. So what's a sensible definition? Well, all I do is just construct all possible permutations of the indices. How many permutations are there of three quantities?
Six.
Six, right? So I've got to write out six terms, and I put 1/6 here, and I put 3 factorial because it's always for n objects, number of permutations is n factorial, and then I write t mu nu rho plus t rho mu nu. So here I'm just cycling things around. So those are all the permutations, if I did it right. And what about the antisymmetric one? Well, we just put minus signs in front of the odd permutations, the one that involved an odd number of exchanges of indices. And so basically this is plus plus minus minus minus. So these are some examples. Let's try to write down a framework where all this somehow happens automatically. And we can do that using these tensors. Let me define a delta with two up and two down indices. Okay, and that's going to be defined to be the determinant of this guy. Sorry, mu. Okay, so what does that mean? That means that I work out this determinant. Okay, and Similarly, I can keep going, so I can define a six index quantity. So I just do delta mu, delta nu, delta lambda, delta mu, delta nu, delta lambda, delta mu, delta nu, delta lambda. And then this one is rho, 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 sigma, 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 tau, tau, tau. Okay? And I won't bother writing that out, but you can work it out. It's a determinant. So I take this one, multiply by that element, and then this 4 by 4, these two multiplied by that with a minus sign, and so on. And what's the point of doing that? Well, the point is that the antisymmetric piece of some tensor is then just the contraction. Okay, so this is a projection onto the antisymmetric piece of a tensor. And likewise, three index guy. And then we have some nice identities involving the epsilon. So in three dimensions, we had epsilon epsilon is delta delta minus delta delta. And you might imagine that's something to do with this formula, which it is. But let's write down all these identities in four dimensions. In 4D, we have epsilon mu nu rho lambda equals 4 factorial. Just a second. I'm worried about a minus.
Minus 4 factorial.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm worried about. so that's a minus sign. Okay, why is that true? Because obviously 0, 1, 2, 3, 0, 1, 2, 3 gives you one term which with a minus 1 because the 0, with the 0 upstairs I get plus 1. So with the 0 downstairs I get minus 1. And then I have 24 permutations of 0, 1, 2, 3. And each one of them will give me the same contribution. And then we have a formula like this. So let's imagine we just contract three of the indices. Then we get 3 factorial delta mu alpha. Presumably also has a minus sign. Okay, and then we can contract two of the indices. And this gives us 1. Then we can contract just one index. Okay. And then the last one. Sign. Okay, so those are kind of nice identities which generalize the formula from 3D, which you know. And the one I'm going to use to show this implies that is this one. Okay, so if I take this formula, so take that formula, just multiply it with another epsilon. So I've got a free index alpha here, so let's multiply this by epsilon alpha psi chi psi. Okay, and then I can use that identity, and so I get a bunch of deltas from this formula, plug them into the left-hand side, and you'll get the right equation. So I'll leave you to work that out. The final point I wanted to make just at the beginning of this lecture is that I guess from the tutorial, some people were a little bit unsure about the derivation of the relativistic Doppler effect. So remember, when we had these two photons in Einstein's derivation of E equals mc squared, we had these two photons. And then we imagined a moving observer. So this is obviously in the rest frame of the original particle, which has decayed. But if I now have a moving observer moving along with some velocity v in that frame, they will see different energies for the particle. So let's work it out in this rest frame. The four velocity of the observer is equal to gamma v, minus gamma v. Okay, why is this true? Just remember the definition. Four velocity is dx mu d tau, right? And then you have the definition of d tau is c squared dt squared minus dx squared. So d tau is c dt is, sorry, d tau is square root, no, d tau is c dt times the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared, because v is equal to dx dt, right? The velocity is just the rate of change of x with respect to t. And so from that, you can see that, so this is dt d tau, actually c dt d tau, because x naught is ct, dx d tau. Dt d tau is 1 over c with that factor, so the c's cancel. So here I get gamma, right? This quantity is 1 over gamma. Dx dt is just, in this case, the dx d tau is dx dt times dt d tau. And then you have 0, 0 in the other components. And so this is nothing but gamma v. The dt d tau is gamma. And dx dt is v over c. So actually, I should have an over c here. It's got to be dimensionless. So that's the four velocity of the observer. And of course, you can check that u mu, u nu, eta mu nu is equal to minus 1. Okay, because the first term here is minus u naught squared minus gamma squared. Second term is plus gamma squared v squared over c squared. And they combine to give minus 1. So that's the four velocity of the observer in this frame. Okay? Now, we know the momentum of the photon. Let's call this photon number one. What is the four momentum of the photon in the same frame, in the rest frame of the particle that decays? Well, I haven't really discussed the... I only discussed a massive particle in the lectures. I didn't discuss the form. I said the four momentum is the rest mass times the four velocities. But for a massless particle, doesn't have a rest mass, so you can't use that definition. Do you want to learn special relativity, Michael?
No, I have a new refresher.
Maybe not now.
He's just admiring the density of Blackboard.
Okay. that's Michael Peskin, who's chair of our scientific advisory committee, who is there visiting this week. Among, we have all possible things happening this week, okay, as you'll notice. And the reason why I'm very scarce is that I'm somehow involved in all of them. So it's a sort of nightmare week for me. For a photon, a photon is null, right? And so it has a four velocity, which is null, doesn't have a rest mass. And so what we do is we simply define the momentum, the four momentum of a photon as follows. We say, and p mu, p nu, eta mu nu equals zero, and that's p naught squared minus p squared. And that p naught is the energy of the photon, actually divided by c, because energy has dimensions of momentum times c. You can see that from half mv squared. So this p naught component of the photon is its energy divided by c. You can adopt that as a definition of the normalization of the photon's energy. So when we write down, in this case, what is the four momentum of the photon, it will be L over 2c, actually an overall factor. So this is equal to L over 2c. Like I say, you take the energy divided by c, and then 1. And this magnitude of the momentum must be equal to p naught, because p mu is null. And so the magnitude of the momentum is L over 2c, but the component along the x direction will be cos phi, if that angle's phi, cos phi. The component in the y direction is sine phi, and in the z direction is zero. Okay, so that's the four momentum of the photon. Now, the energy in the photon of the photon in the rest frame of the decaying particle was, by definition, L over 2. The question I want to know is, what is the energy in the rest frame of this observer? Okay, so this observer is moving, and they will see a Doppler shift of the photon. Photons made out of waves, and they'll see those waves Doppler shifted. So they'll see this guy with the higher energy and this guy with the lower energy, because it's moving away. So how do you calculate that? Well, the easy way to do it is to compute the following quantity, minus p 1 mu u mu over c. So I'm going to claim that this is the energy of the photon of photon 1 in the rest frame of the observer. Why is that true? Well, in the rest frame of the observer, you see, this is a Lorentz invariant quantity because the indices are contracted. So I can calculate it any frame I like. In particular, I could calculate it in the rest frame of the observer. In the rest frame of the observer, this is equal to the four velocity is just 1. Okay? And so in the rest frame of the observer, when I calculate this quantity, I get exactly the energy of the photon because I just project out the P0 component in that frame. Okay, so this is the four velocities. So in the rest frame of photon of the observer, this equals to minus P1 mu over C. Dotted into that vector, which is just that should be a minus 1 here. Remember, u mu is equal to dx mu d tau, and in the rest frame of the particle, T and tau are equal, and so this will be 1, 0. So when I calculate u mu with lowered indices, I've got to put an extra minus sign in. And
isn't the minus sign just in the spatial part?
No. The eta mu nu has a minus sign in the time component. So when you lower an index of u, when you lower the index of u, you put a minus sign in the time direction. Okay, so this quantity is here. Now there may be factors, so I think that's right. So it's minus 1, 0. And now dotted in with this guy. So this has an upstairs. In, you see, when the indices are like this, I just sum over them. There are no extra minus signs to worry about. So I guess I want that's right. So this is equal to the energy of the photon in this frame over C. Why did I want it? That is the energy of the photon. It's P, I don't want that. Sorry, talking nonsense. It's PC. That's an energy. It's because I always put C equals 1. That's the energy. Okay, so P mu C has dimensions of energy. And this will be the energy of photon in the rest frame of the observer. So that's the quantity I want. I want to know the energy in the rest frame of the observer. And so all I do is take the four momentum of the photon and dot it in with the four velocity of the observer. Another way of saying this is in relativity, the energy depends on who the observer is. Different observers measure different energies. So if you want to define the energy, you better tell me the observer. And that's the formula that gives you the energy. Now, I still don't know what it is, okay? But what I can do is I know this quantity doesn't matter which Lorentz frame I compute it in. And so let's compute it in the frame where I know everything. So I certainly know the four velocity of the observer in the rest frame of the decaying particle, and I know the four momentum of the photon in that frame. So all I have to do is take this dot product, and it'll give me this quantity I want. So in the rest frame of the decaying particle, this is equal to, so I've got to take this 4 vector for the photon and this 4 vector for the decaying particle and dot them into each other. I do that using eta. Uh, And so let's see if I can get the algebra right. I'm going to get an extra minus sign because I have to lower the index on the u in the time component. So I'm going to get, let's see, so it's minus L over 2c. Took the minus sign, that L over 2c factor. And then I will lower, get minus gamma multiplied by 1. So this component with the extra minus sign times the 1. And then the other pieces will be minus gamma v cos phi. And so this is equal to gamma L over 2. I've got a factor of c I have to multiply by. So gamma L over 2 times 1 plus v cos phi. Okay, so that is the relativistic Doppler effect. And it's bigger than it was in the other
frame. V over c cos.
Oh, thanks. Okay. Yeah, you can see why people put c equals 1. Okay, any questions about that? So now I want to tell you a little bit more about electromagnetism. I've lost the notes. Okay, I'll just do it by memory. Hope it works. In fact, I'll leave it till next time. Otherwise, we'll get minus signs and stuff. I was going to tell you about the stress energy tensor, but I'm happy to leave that till next time. Okay, so let's go on to the next topic, which is the definition of a manifold. Okay, so a manifold is a very, very basic concept in mathematics. And in theoretical physics, and essentially it's our model of or our picture of what space-time is. This is the picture people use as a rubber sheet, that space-time is a flexible quantity, a flexible entity, and it's a natural generalization. Of Minkowski space or space-time, which we also refer to as flat space-time. Okay, so just as a piece of paper is flat and a sphere is curved, Minkowski space we think of as being flat, even though there's time and space. It's not curved, and the manifold is going to be the curved version of Minkowski space-time. And so, loosely speaking, what it is a topological space. That means a collection of points with some relationships, which is locally Rn. Actually, I should say locally Mn, Minkowski space. Okay, so this n here means the dimension. Okay, and the M stands for Minkowski space, but we may also consider manifolds that are locally look like just n-dimensional Euclidean space. Okay, so this is Minkowski space. And this means Euclidean. So just x, y, z, u, v, w, etc., some n-dimensional version of space, and only labeled by the real numbers which can specify the coordinates. So that's roughly the picture of a manifold. The way to draw it is you think of some curved space, and then locally, at every point, it looks like a little piece of flat space. And that's the intuitive picture of a manifold. We'll define it in a little more detail as we go along. And I'm not going to be mathematically rigorous at all in this course. In fact, I wanted to read you a funny little quote of Feynman, which I found yesterday. Which is, so one of the things you'll notice about general relativity and the books, go to the library, you'll find 100 books, many very mathematical, right? You do not need to know all that stuff, okay? Very important to be very selective in what you read and form your own picture, your own mental picture of what you're doing, and develop the level of mathematical rigor you need and no more. So Feynman's quote is the following: we can't define anything precisely. Okay? It's a pretty strong statement. If we attempt to, we get into that paralysis of thought that comes to philosophers. One saying to the other, "You don't know what you're talking about." The second one says, "What do you mean by talking? What do you mean by you? What do you mean by no?" So, that's basically my attitude. So when we play with mathematics as physicists, going for the very highest level of rigor is definitely not the game. Okay, we should know what we're doing in some intuitive sense and believe it, and be able to demonstrate it to other people, but we absolutely do not need to or want to define things to the highest level. So intuitive pictures are very, very important, and we can actually test for whether they make sense in many different ways. So don't be paralyzed. Okay. What are some examples? And again, this is a typical physicist's method, rather than even trying to define this precisely. Let's just try and define what we want to think about. So some examples, well, Rn is a manifold. It's just space, x, y, z, in n dimensions. And that certainly counts as a manifold. It's locally Rn. In fact, it's exactly Rn. So that must be a manifold. We also have an n-dimensional sphere. So an n-dimensional sphere is a set of points in Rn obeying x1 squared plus x2 squared plus x3 squared plus xn squared equals 1. And so that's a very familiar manifold that looks like this. And we'll use two-sphere often as an example. Yep.
It's Sn minus 1.
Thanks. Rn plus 1. Plus 1. Thank you. Another example is actually interesting to think about: what is S0? What is a zero-dimensional sphere? Two points. X equals plus or minus 1. Okay. That's also a manifold. Locally, it looks like R0, which is a space of zero dimensions. There are two points. And locally, it consists of 2 points, so it's also a manifold by this loose definition. What about a torus? So torus, I take, well, let me do e.g. T2, a two-dimensional torus. I just take the plane and draw a square, for example, and then identify these edges. Okay, so what the arrow means is that I identify this point with this point and so on. All the points on these lines are just identified. Maybe I should put two arrows here to show this whole line is identified with that line. You literally think about this as cutting a piece of paper, closing it up, and gluing it together on those lines. And if I do both of these, then I'm going to get something like this. Okay, so this is a torus, and if I cut it on a circle, that will be one of these lines. And if I go around the equator, that will be the other line. Okay. So, more complicated, slightly more complicated bottle, complicated case is a Klein bottle, where I do the same thing, but put in a twist. And I just refer you to the Wikipedia article, which has lots of very beautiful pictures of a Klein bottle. Okay, but that's also a manifold. And so then your question might be, what is not a manifold? Okay, so anybody think of something that's not a manifold? Geometrical space that's not a manifold.
The line is arrays from this zero.
Pardon?
Two lines crossing.
Yeah, that's not a good manifold. Any one of them is fine, because locally it just looks like R1. But this point is a bit strange. It's not just like a copy of R1. Similarly, we could imagine a membrane, and that's the technical name for a M2 brain in M theory. Looks like a two-dimensional membrane, and we could attach a string to it at a point, so the string is forced to live with one end of it on the membrane. And these things occur in string theory, okay? But they're definitely not manifolds. So it's already clear from that certainly if you're interested in building a unified theory of everything, you have to be a bit more broad-minded than to think only about manifolds. But the manifold is a good starting point. Another example, if I take a cone which or two cones, and I join their tips together, then this point does not look like a piece of R2, and that's not a manifold. But this is actually a good model of a bouncing universe. And again, there's evidence that such things are allowed in quantum gravity. And there are many other examples where, in fact, we know that the strictly taking space, or even just space, to be a manifold is too narrow a definition of what is allowed. But that's what we're going to do.
So one cone would also not be
enough, okay? No, one cone is fine because let's see. I mean, I can think about this as a piece. You see, topologically, so just take that cone and squish it down flat. That's still fine. It's topologically the same as a plane. When we put a metric on it, then we'll find the metric has a curvature singularity at the point. But a manifold is a much more elementary notion than, it doesn't need a metric. It's just a space with a collection of relations between the points. Another example is De Sitter space. Or De Sitter space-time. Okay, so the very simplest sort of non-trivial manifold in Euclidean space is a sphere, as we discussed. So you could say, what is the simplest example of a non-trivial manifold which looks locally like four-dimensional Minkowski space and has the greatest possible symmetry? Okay, so Minkowski space is an example, but it's not very interesting because it's just trivial. De Sitter space is the example, and that's where our universe is going, right? Our universe is dominated by dark energy. It's now 75% of the material in the universe is dark energy. All the matter and radiation is being diluted away by the expansion, but the dark energy will dominate, and the solution of Einstein's equations, when you have only vacuum energy, turns out to be De Sitter space-time, and that's just the space minus x naught squared plus x 1 squared plus x 2 squared plus x 3 squared plus x 4 squared equals 1. So just like a sphere, but with a minus sign over here. Okay. And that is within five-dimensional Minkowski space. So take five-dimensional Minkowski space and draw this surface. Okay, that's De Sitter space. So I'll just leave it to you to make a picture. It has a beautiful picture of what De Sitter space is, but I'll leave it to you to figure out what it is. Draw it and work out work out a nice set of coordinates. Four coordinates. These are five coordinates. Okay, so just like on a sphere, lives in three dimensions. A two sphere is in three dimensions. And we can describe it with x1, x2, x3 subjected to a constraint. But more convenient, usually, is to use polar angles, for example, theta and phi. And so I'm just asking you to figure out what's the analog of polar angles for De Sitter space. OK, so now let's give a slightly more detailed definition of a manifold. So a manifold is a set of points where every point is an open neighborhood
Okay, so if I'm talking about a manifold that's locally Rn or Mn, then every point should have an open neighborhood which has a continuous one-to-one map onto an open set of Rn. So let me draw a picture and then I'll give you the definition of all these words. So here is M and some point. It has a neighborhood, and you can think about that as just a patch. So the whole idea of a manifold really is just very, very simple one of just gluing together pieces of things which look like Rn. So let's take one of those pieces, U, and we'll draw some coordinates on it. That's U. And this is going to get mapped into Rn. Some region of Rn. Whoops. And so these lines of constant coordinate are just mapped onto the obvious straight lines in Rn. And so this is called the image phi of U. So one-to-one, so a map should be an obvious thing. A map is something that takes each point to another point. That's all it does. A map is one-to-one if every point in the image has only one point of U mapped onto it. Onto is, again, something you don't really need to worry about. It does have a technical mathematical definition. But essentially, it just means that the map, if you take U and you apply the map, then actually you cover the whole of the image. That's all that onto means. You cover all of the image. So, for example, so the region phi, the region is the region. So you see, it's mapping us onto an open set of Rn. So I define some open set Rn, and this map covers that whole region. So the region is covered by the map. So let's give some examples. I can map R to R, real numbers to real numbers, okay, by just defining a function. So f of x versus x, any curve defines a map from x to f, which is from real numbers to real numbers. So let me draw a few of them and ask you to tell me if they're one-to-one or onto. So for example, let me draw e to the x. So is that one-to-one? Does every point on x get mapped to one point on f? Yes. Okay. Is it onto? Does the map cover the entire real axis? No. Okay, so this is e to the x equals 1 to 1, but not onto. If I draw this curve, okay, is that 1 to 1? Is every as it, does every point F, does every point on F have only one point of X mapped to it? No, because here there are three points, right? There are three different value of X's and they all have the same value of F. So that, in that case, it's three to one, and so on. So play around with these curves and you can discover maps which have any combination of these properties. So then a simple statement is that a one-to-one onto map is invertible. Okay? That's obvious because each point goes to one point, and you ask, where does it come from? It comes from that point. So you can just invert it. And so there exists. So if phi maps M to N, there exists an inverse, phi inverse mapping N back to N. Okay, so I still haven't defined this open neighborhood. So the idea here is to start from an open ball in Rn or Mn, whichever space I'm working in. Actually, let me stick to Rn for the moment because Mn is a bit more subtle. But let's just stick to Rn. An open ball is defined to be the set of x such that the modulus of x minus y is less than r. Okay, so that's a very obvious, the point y is over here. And then this open ball is all points whose distance from y is less than r. Okay, and that's a strict less than. So you do not include the surface of the ball. So it's the, i.e., the interior of the ball. And then an open set in Rn is defined to be an arbitrary, to be the union of an arbitrary number, maybe infinity, open balls. So the picture of an open set is that you can draw any closed surface you like in Rn, and its interior can be built of just putting lots and lots and lots of open balls in there, and that's an open set in Rn. The definition of an open neighborhood in M, so that is our that is our manifold. The open neighborhood in M, by definition, is a set which is mapped 1-to-1 onto an open set of Rn. Okay, so manifold is really just constructed by patching together pieces of space or sets which look like Rn. Sorry, it's okay. Sorry, this is math. It's a bit boring. Another important concept you should have for the manifold is that of a C infinity atlas on M. Okay, so these are words you will see in every introductory textbook. I just want to give you a picture of what they mean. You will not, for the most part, use any of this, but I don't want you to. I just want you to have a sense of what the more mathematical definitions are. And so a C infinity atlas, what does that mean? Well, C infinity means continuous. And so CP means that you've got some function whose derivatives up to the pth derivative, including the pth derivative, are continuous. Okay, C infinity means infinitely continuous, so you can differentiate it as many times as you like, and all those derivatives are continuous. That's really just for convenience. What does an atlas mean? An atlas is just basically a collection of charts. You see, each one of these is called a chart. So it's just like covering the world with different charts or maps, and an atlas comprises all of these charts. So the picture is as following. I have my space M. Let's imagine I have two of these open neighborhoods, U beta, U alpha, and they can overlap. Okay, and then each one of them gets mapped to a copy of Rn. So here's some Rn. And when it's mapped, it'll look something like this with that extra piece. And so obviously this here is phi of u beta. And this piece gets mapped to another portion of Rn. And likewise, we'll have this picture. And this is phi alpha of U alpha. This is phi beta. So phi beta is mapping that guy to Rn, and phi alpha is mapping this one to Rn. So in order for this picture to make sense, obviously we want all these maps to be compatible. Okay? And what you should think of is essentially each one of these is a coordinate system. So it might be convenient to use one coordinate system on this open neighborhood. But you can use a completely different coordinate system on the second open neighborhood. But where they both cover the same region of the space, you better make sure that there is a way to go from one to the other, which is C infinity. Okay, so that's the definition of a... So this will allow you to change coordinates in going from one patch to the other. And so the change in coordinates is just the map going from here to there, which would be phi beta phi alpha minus 1. This little circle here means the composition of maps. So if I want to go from this point in Rn to that point, sorry, and I really mean within these regions, within the overlap regions. If I want to change coordinates from these coordinates to those, the way I get there is I have to go back to the manifold, to the point on the manifold, and then I follow this map into that copy of Rn. Okay, so that's what this means. You go back to the manifold, and then you come back to the second coordinate system. And likewise, this one is phi alpha phi beta. Okay, and so the definition of a C infinity atlas of C infinity atlas on M equals the collection of all maps of neighborhoods and maps phi and u and phi of u for which the transition functions these quantities, phi beta, phi alpha inverse. It's called a transition function because it enables you to go from one coordinate system to another, R, C, infinity. And they're really just functions because these are functions from Rn to Rn. Okay, so that was a somewhat heavy definition. Let's go back to examples. Yep.
What does it say before plus maps?
Sorry?
What does it say before plus maps?
Neighborhoods.
Neighborhoods. Sorry. Okay, so let's just look at some examples. Simple one is a circle. So the circle, when we try to think about it as a neighborhood, we're interested in mapping open sets from the circle, open neighborhoods of the circle, into R1. So how do I map a circle onto a line? Can I do it? Yeah.
You use four projections. So you
four. Projections.
You do upper half.
But can I do it with one? Can I map the entirety of the circle to a line?
No. Yes, you can.
Pardon?
You can.
I can map this whole circle to a line,
yes,
such that I satisfy all these conditions, right?
No.
What? Sorry?
Not all of them. It's not one to one.
It's not one to one, yeah. So in particular, if I use the coordinate theta goes from 0 to 2 pi, the problem is that the map is one, well, it doesn't exist, but if there was one, it would be one to many, because there are two points on the line, on the real line, namely 0 and 2 pi, which correspond to the same point on the circle. Okay, so you cannot cover the circle with one coordinate chart. But what you can do is use two. Okay, so let's say this is U1, And let's say that one is U2. Okay, so they overlap. And both of them can just be theta. But U2 is just not defined outside of, I shouldn't really draw it like this. These are open neighborhoods. Okay, so they don't have the endpoint. So just give a range of theta between one value and another value, and that's a mapping from the circle to the real line. And then give the other range of theta from another one value to another. Make sure your ranges overlap. And then you can easily go, you can describe everything using these coordinates. Then you can change from this coordinate to that coordinate, describe everything up here. And locally, it's always R1. So slightly more complicated case is a two-sphere. Same thing is true. What are the problem with polar coordinates? So polar coordinates take me from a two-sphere into R2, right? Theta and phi. So I've got my two-sphere. And if I draw my R2, so theta normally we take to be to go from 0 to pi, right, the one polar angle. The other one goes from 2 to 2 pi. And which lines in that diagram are problematical?
Pi, 1, 0, or pi is a line, but it's just one
point. Yeah, exactly. So again, if there was a map, it would be many. It would be 1 to many, which doesn't make any sense. Because there are many values of phi which correspond to the same point. Theta. So we say the coordinates here are degenerate. There are too many values for the coordinates to correspond to the number of points. So these lines are bad. And what about these lines? The same problem as the circle. Okay, so these are really bad. Really bad. This is not a good description of the manifold. Okay, it just completely fails on the boundary. Now, there is a nice description which involves two coordinate charts, and it's called projective coordinates. Actually, sorry, it's called stereographic coordinates. On the sphere, so these are much better than polar coordinates. And so what we do is we take our sphere and we'll draw the plane so this plane here is x3 equals minus 1. Okay, so the sphere is x1 squared plus x2 squared plus x3 squared equals 1. And I can draw the tangent plane at x3 equals minus 1. The origin is here. Tangent plane to the sphere. And so the sphere is just sitting on that plane. The definition of stereographic coordinates is that I start from the north pole, find some point on the sphere, and then just draw a straight line through that point, right, until it hits this plane. I draw another point here. Okay, it will hit the plane at some value of x1 and x2. And I'll call that value y1, y2. This point on the sphere is, of course, x1, x2, x3. So y1 is the value of x1 on that where the line hits the plane. Now we can work the formula out very easily because if I imagine, for example, that this line lies in the xy plane, then if the line lies at if the line lies in the x2 equals 0 plane, then it's easy to draw the geometry. And so I simply draw this line. This is x1. This is x3. And now we can see, oh, I should have drawn it the other way. Let me draw it the other way just so to keep everything positive. Draw it this way. So this distance here is x1. This distance here is, so the point is located at x3, so this distance is 1 minus x3. Up the stairs. Okay, so we've got a triangle whose sides are x1 and 1 minus x3, because the radius is 1. But I can relate that to this coordinate. This is, of course, y1. Y1 is the value of x1 where the line hits the x3 equals minus 1 plane. And by similar triangles, you can see that y1 over 2 is equal to x1 over 1 minus x3. And so we have that y1, y2 equals 2x1 over 1 minus x3. 2x2 over 1 minus x3. Okay, so I just worked out the case where it's in the plane, but then obviously you can simply rotate that around. So x1 rotates into x2, and that's the formula for y1, y2. So those are good coordinates on the sphere, except they break down at one point. What's the point where they break down? X3 equals 1, which is the north pole. So you can construct another set of coordinates based on the south pole, and all you do is change the plus to a minus, the minus to a plus. Similarly, the south pole stereographic coordinates and so they would have, let's call it z1, z2. Again, the values of x1 and x2, where the line hits the plane. This time I draw the plane up here. Okay, and I draw a line from the south pole through the sphere to hit the plane. And these are now given by x1 over 1 plus x3. Now singular at x3 equals minus 1. 2x2 over 1 plus x3. And so there are two charts which cut to which together cover S2. And they overlap. The overlap region is x3 between 1 and minus 1. Okay, so they overlap everywhere on the sphere except for those two points. And then I'll leave it to you as an exercise to check that the transition function transition function just means change of coordinates from the y to the z is given by, so phi 2, or let's say phi north pole projective inverse phi south pole is given by z1 or z1 is equal to 4 y1 over y1 squared plus y2 squared. And z2 is given by 4y2 over y1 squared plus y2 squared. Okay, and that is, which is C infinity in the overlap region. What is the overlap region in terms of y1 and y2?
All.
It's everything, right? Except infinity. And so if you differentiate these functions as many times as you like, if you're not at the point infinity, you never have any problem. So they are C infinity. So this is an example of a manifold which requires two coordinate charts to cover it. There are examples of manifolds which have some non-trivial topology, but nevertheless only require one coordinate chart to cover it. Okay, and I'll give you an example and ask you to find the coordinate system which covers it, but which covers it properly, one-to-one and all that, but you only need one of them. Okay, so I'll just leave it to you to worry about this example. Find a single coordinate system brackets chart covering a cylinder S1 times R. Okay, so you know what a cylinder is. It's a circle where I just extend it in the z direction to plus and minus infinity. And so it runs. So it's just a product of a circle. And every point on the cylinder lives somewhere on the circle and somewhere on R. And it's got some topology, obviously. I can wind around the cylinder a certain number of times. But I want you to find a coordinate system which represents this one-to-one everywhere, except for the ends of the cylinder, which are at plus or minus infinity. Okay? I'm not too worried about those. Covering the cylinder except at the 2n. Well, let me just say, except at plus and minus infinity. Okay, so that's a useful exercise to do. And so I want to now just draw one more picture, which will sort of tell us how we do calculus on manifolds. Okay, so manifold essentially is a very boring idea. Okay, we've got a good picture of space. It's just Euclidean space, x, y, and z. And the manifold is the closest you can keep to that space, to that picture. You just take pieces of space and glue them together. And when we want to deal with a curved manifold, what do? Well, we just map pieces of it into Euclidean space. And then we find the maps from the different pieces, from the different copies of Euclidean space. And those are functions. And then we make sure they're differentiable. And that's all it is. So that's how we do calculus on manifolds. We just map pieces of the manifold to flat space. So let me draw a picture. So imagine I've got some manifold M, And imagine I have some other manifold, N. And they don't even have to be the same dimension. Okay? So for example, this could be space-time. This could be the space of gauge fields. Okay? Or the space of, you know, some other space. All that we have is the idea that there is a map from this space to that space. Okay, so what is physics? What are the objects in physics? The objects are usually maps from one space to another space. Say we take electromagnetic field. Well, it's a map from real space and time to the space of fields. Okay, B and E fields. So this is a very generic sort of setup in physics. And how do we deal with it if these are not Rn, if these are not just Euclidean space? And so the way we deal with it is by mapping each of them onto Euclidean space. So space-time gets mapped, this open neighborhood in space-time gets mapped onto a piece of Rn, or Mn, if I'm doing Minkowski space. Rm. And I can think of these as being the coordinates xi, I equals 1 to m. And similarly, I do the same thing with n, so I call that psi, and I map this to Rm. And the coordinates here are yi, or yj, j equals 1 up to n. And so how am I going to do calculus on this map? You know, you can't really do it up here because you don't know how to differentiate or anything like that. But you do know how to differentiate down here, so that's where you do it. So you consider a mapping from you consider how do I go from a point x here to a point y over there, and this is of course given by psi. So the way I get from here to there, right, is I've got to go back to this M, then across here, and then down. These are the only maps I have. So this is psi composed with F composed with phi inverse. I start with a phi inverse, I go up to here, I then do the F, and then I do the psi. And this is really what the function F means. Okay, so this mapping is the function f of x. Okay, so f of x is some function mapping me from here to there. I should think physically of it really being a map which sort of has its own existence independent of these specific coordinate systems. But this is actually how f of x is defined. So now I can differentiate it. So when I write down something like df dx mu, what do I mean? I actually mean d by dx mu of psi composed with f composed with phi inverse evaluated at the coordinates x. Okay, now we're never going to use expressions like this. If you look in a math textbook, you'll find it's full of expressions like this. This is how mathematicians prefer to think about the problem. Really, in terms of the mapping, and every time you differentiate, you've got to map it into Rn, and then differentiate it, and then map it back onto your manifold, and so on. And most of the time, we're just going to drop all that and deal with this quantity. But it is important, and you'll see as we go through the course, it's actually important at various moments to realize, what am I really doing here when I differentiate things? Because that'll give you the geometrical picture of what they mean. Okay, so I think that's all for today. And next time we'll do tensors on manifolds. Are there any questions?
For the two maps of sphere.
Yeah.
They are not function from one to another. It's not well defined in zero.
That's true. Presumably it fails here and there. Yeah, it's got to fail at both points because they're both equally bad. Clearly this is singular at infinity. And I guess the statement is if you try to invert it, you'd have problems at zero. Any other questions? Oh, I've got a handout for you. As I mentioned, those of you who want to do a little bit more reading, there's a very beautiful physics reports article called Gravitation Gauge Theories and Differential Geometry. And basically, this is designed for physicists to get them as quickly as possible to frontline mathematics in differential geometry. So it's kind of informal. It will not kill you with mappings and all kinds of rigorous definitions. And I would strongly advise you to read a little bit of this. For example, a nice definition of a manifold is the complex projective space. Okay, so it's kind of one step up from a sphere. You'll find that on page 220. And one of the interesting things that's actually happening at perimeter is that complex projective space and related constructions are now understood to play a very fundamental role in the scattering amplitudes of gauge particles. And so this will kind of give you a taste if you're interested in that work. It'll give you just a little taste of what that is. And complex projective space is a very beautiful manifold, but it's not something which is covered in any undergraduate physics course, as far as I know. So I thought it would be, do have a look at this. I've just given you the first 20 pages of this article, and it's very introductory, but if you have some spare time, do have a look at it. Okay, I'll just leave them there.